It's great to be here. Don't worry, we're not going to go through this whole thing. I probably should ask how many of you actually want to be here. I hear some of you might be being forced to be here. I don't want to do that. So I gave you a lengthy handout just because a lot of this we're barely going to be able to touch on, but these are probably questions you might have, and I've suggested some other resources. If you look at the top of the page, of page one, if you want to study further, some good resources. I have an easy resource that's about 100 pages by the great British scholar F.F. Bruce. Some intermediate works by Blomberg, 250 pages, 440 pages. Jesus and the Gospels is the 440. And then advanced, those are pretty thick books. N.T. Wright, the Bishop of Durham, he's an Anglican bishop. He's in the process of writing a 6-volume introduction to the New Testament. And those are advanced, they're accessible to people who don't know Greek, but they are more advanced and a little bit more difficult. So those are some further studies that I would recommend if you're interested in this subject more. I said on there that the purpose of this talk is not to prove the inspiration of Scripture or inerrancy of Scripture or anything like that. We're just stepping back and we're asking the question, are the Gospels historically reliable? When you open up a Bible and you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, can you trust that what you're reading actually happened? And the reason this is an important subject for us to consider is because for most people in the United States today, many of them would say, I'm not real sure that they're very accurate. There are a number of reasons for that. One is the Da Vinci Code. I did not update my Da Vinci Code. That this is old information, 47 weeks, 6.5 million sold was back in April, I think. So now, who knows how long it was on the number one on the bestseller list. How many of y'all have read the Da Vinci Code? That's it. Y'all have heard of the Da Vinci Code? I'll talk about that in a second. There are also, whenever you get around Easter time or even Christmas, you'll generally have some articles in Newsweek or Time or U.S. News and World Report that'll say some things about the Jesus Seminar. We'll talk about that a little bit later. It's a kind of a popular group of academicians who get together and they vote on the things of Jesus using red beads if they think he said it, pink if they think he might have said it, gray if he might not have said it, and black if there's no way he said it. And so it's something that goes well into print, and so it's kind of this thing that people have heard a lot about. And a lot of times you'll hear, you know, scholars say the Gospels are not reliable. And the word scholar in the United States is kind of, it has a lot of influence behind it. It's kind of a scary term. And so sometimes there are people who say, well, scholars say that, it must be true. We're going to talk about that. Not all scholars say that, and in fact, not most scholars say that. So we're going to talk about that. We're not going to read this whole part of the Da Vinci Code I quote here, but in the center of the Da Vinci Code, they come to this professor's house, Professor Teabing, and it's about the only slow part in the whole book. It's a page turner of a book. And it kind of slows down and they kind of talk about the history of Christianity, the history of the Bible. And so I have here, the underlinings are all mine. I think the italics are original. But if you look at the smaller print, about that second underlined section, the Bible is a product of man, my dear, not of God. The Bible did not fall magically from the clouds. Man created it as a historical record of tumultuous times, and it has evolved through countless translations, editions, and revisions. History has never had a definitive version of the book. So here's a claim being made, and now Dan Brown, obviously, why am I interacting with the Da Vinci Code? Let me just say this. Dan Brown, obviously, it's a work of fiction. But at the very front of the book, he says on one of the title pages, every statement about a document in this book is true and accurate. And what I'm telling you is No historian in the United States would agree with that statement. Dan Brown is a lawyer, not a historian, and many things that he talks about and claims are false, and we'll talk about some of those. A little bit further down, he says, more than 80 Gospels, this is underlined, were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them. The 80 is a way over estimation, and we'll talk about that when we get to the canon. Well, who chose which Gospels to include, Sophie asks. Aha, Teabing burst in with enthusiasm. The fundamental irony of Christianity. The Bible as we know it today was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great. We'll talk about that when we get to canon. Earlier, he was talking about transmission of the text, saying there are problems with the transmission of the text. Here he's talking about the canon, the text that we actually have in front of us. And so a little bit further down that next underlined section, hold on. You're saying Jesus' divinity was the result of a vote? A relatively close vote at that, Teabing added, which actually isn't true either, but that's a different lecture. But down at the bottom of that section, it was all about power. Christ as Messiah was critical to the functioning of church and state. Many scholars claim that the early church literally stole Jesus from his original followers, hijacking his human message, shrouding it in an impenetrable cloak of divinity, and using it to expand their own power. A little bit further, page 2 actually at the top, you can read all the rest of that later. To rewrite the history books, Constantine knew he would need a bold stroke. From this sprang the most profound moment in Christian history. Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible, which omitted those Gospels that spoke of Christ's human traits and embellished those Gospels that made him godlike. The earlier Gospels were outlawed, gathered up, and burned. What I mean is that almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. Now, again, Da Vinci Code, am I saying, you know, I mean, this room, probably some of y'all are not real interested in Christianity, some of you are. Am I saying don't read the Da Vinci Code? No, I'm not. But read it for what it really is, and that is a page-turner, an interesting novel, very interesting. Don't read it to get your history. What happens is there are some people who read it, some non-Christians read it and say, see, I don't even need to look into this thing, Christianity, if this is what's actually going on. And then Christians read it sometimes, and they don't know whether they can trust the Gospels, and so they think, well, why am I doing this? Why do I go to church? Why should I be involved in the Gospel at all? So point number one, question number one, I've got this in a series of questions. Number one, and by the way, as Kevin said, at any point you want to interrupt me, just raise your hand and ask a question, and I might defer it till later depending on what the question is. Number one, does it matter? There are some people that would say faith and history are two different things. So it really doesn't matter if what the Gospels say are true or not because my faith is not connected to history. Faith is a blind leap in the dark. Faith is something that you just close your eyes and you believe whatever you want to believe. Well, the problem is that is not the way the Scriptures talk about faith. Faith is based on something. Now, it is, you know, there are Scriptures that say things like we walk by faith, not by sight. But that doesn't mean we're not walking by reason at all. What some people would say is to be a Christian, check your brain at the door, and then you can become a Christian. But that is not what is being said at all. What the Scriptures say is check this out. In fact, Paul, when he's appearing before Festus and King Agrippa, says, this was not done in a corner. These are things you can look into and investigate. And so check out to see if this happens. He was saying, check it out. He wasn't saying, well, it doesn't really matter if they happen or not. Just believe. No one, in no other area of life, would you ever say, it doesn't matter if this is true or not. Just believe. Think about that in terms of going to a doctor. If you're going to a doctor and you want them to operate on you, what do you want to know about that doctor? You want to know, where did she get her degree, right? Did she get it at a school that's reputable? Has she done a great job? Has she been sued for killing a lot of people on the surgical table? You want to know these things before you lay down on that table and let her operate on you. If she got her degree, from Nashville Tech. This isn't the pick on Nashville Tech, but I don't think they have a medical program. So, you know, she got it by mail-in, pay your money and get a diploma, then you don't want to trust her. When you lay down for her to operate on you, you are putting your faith in her to a degree. When you get in a car, you're putting your faith in that car. And so Christianity operates the same way all faith operates. Can I trust this or not? And in fact, here's how important it is. Every religion has teachings and events. So here we go. Here's teachings over here. Here are events over here. In other religions, the events are there to point to the teachings. So you can read about Muhammad running into the cave and the spider web being woven over the cave. But the point is not that you really need to believe that event happened. The point is, Muhammad is a prophet, listen to him. The Buddha, you can find out things about the Buddha's life, but the point is not Buddha has done something that is historically important. It is that Buddha is the true enlightenment. And so listen to him, follow him. In Christianity, these are reversed. The teachings are there to point to the events. The core of Christianity is the history. Because the claim of Christianity is that there is a triune God, that the second person of that Trinity came down, took on human flesh, lived a righteous life, died on the cross, was buried, was raised from the dead, ascended into heaven. That is the core of the Christian belief, the core of the Christian doctrine. And so all the teaching points to those events. So if those events aren't true, you no longer have Christianity. So does this matter? It matters significantly. You lose grace. You know, the gospel is not that you do something and so God gives you salvation. It's that something has been done for you. That's the gospel. Something has been done for you that you receive. The something that was done for you is the life, death, resurrection of Jesus Christ. So whether this is historically reliable is very, very important to Christianity. Very significant. Why do we need to talk about it? We need to talk about it because of what I've just said and because you don't have to know. Y'all don't need to go and read all the books. Some of you might go into studies of the ancient Near East or New Testament literature, Old Testament literature. You could go into studies where you would study this for the rest of your life. You don't have to go into studies. But if you're a non-Christian, if you don't believe the gospel, you need to look into this because this may be the thing. It might be that you're not looking at this thing called the gospel because you really think the Bible probably isn't trustworthy. On the other hand, if you're a Christian, you need to be able to know there are answers to questions. And if you read something like the Da Vinci Code, you can realize that what's being presented as some kind of scholarship is not. Also, it is the historical aspect of Christianity that makes the universal claim. You can read on that. Any questions about that? All of them so far have said this is important. It's important because history is the heart of Christianity. You take history away, you no longer have Christianity. You might have a nice moral club, but you can have your club. What I'm interested in is the gospel, the heart of Christianity. All right, let's get into these things about the gospel. Okay, when were the gospels written? Were they close enough to the actual events to be considered reliable? This is the eyewitness test. And the test goes like this. Were they written close enough to the events that eyewitnesses both for and against could have called attention to errors? And the answer is yes. I have here for you the late dates that some scholars would give. Okay, I'm going to walk out a timeline. Here is the birth of Christ. He was born about 4 years before Christ. Did y'all know that Jesus was born before Christ? The dating, y'all know that. So 4 B.C. is around 4 to 3 B.C. is when Jesus is born. He dies around 30 A.D. Jerusalem is destroyed around 70 A.D. And then you have the end of the century. I didn't do that very well, but that's kind of the lay of the land. The late dates that most scholars would give are Matthew in 85 to 90, Mark in 65, Luke 80 to 85, John 95 to 100. So all in this area. Some conservative and some liberal scholars move it back further. J.T. Robinson, I quote in here, redating the New Testament. He's a liberal scholar. He's not trying to prove inerrancy or anything like that. He just goes back and he says, you know what? The Gospels are a lot earlier than we're saying they are. And he's written this whole book defending that to earlier dates, so 40 to 65 A.D. And so Bruce summarizes with this. Even with the later dates, the situation is encouraging from the historian's point of view, for the first three Gospels were written at a time when many were alive who could remember the things Jesus said and did, and some at least would still be alive when the fourth Gospel was written. That's with the late dates. With the earlier dates, it gets even closer. Top of page 3, you see another Bruce quote. Paul's letters, also pointing to the historical aspects of the Gospels, are even earlier. They're definitely, everybody dates them from the 40s to the 60s. And so that's earlier. That's liberal and conservative would date them in that time as well. So at any rate, the time elapsing between the evangelic events and the writing of most of the New Testament books was, from the standpoint of historical research, satisfactorily short. So in other words, the first question, are they written close enough to the event to be reliable? The answer is yes. The next question, how do we know that the copies of the Gospels we have are faithful to the originals? Have the documents been corrupted as they have been transmitted? Remember what we read in the Da Vinci Code. Thousands of transmissions, additions, and subtractions is what Dan Brown writes in that section. So, there are over 5,000 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Several important full manuscripts go back to early and mid-4th century, so 250 years after the original documents were written. Now, that sounds like a long time to us. It goes back even further. Earlier still is a fragment of the Papyrus Codex dated to around 130. We get back very, very close to the originals with some partials, but we have full within 250 years. That sounds far to us. So look in that bold sentence there in the middle. We have stronger textual evidence for the text of the Gospels than any other ancient document. The earliest existing copy of Virgil is 350 years later. For Plato, 1,300 years. Now, if you're a philosophy student and you go to study Plato in class, you will read the Platonic writings, and it is assumed you're reading what Plato wrote. Your professor will argue over turns of phrases. And the closest manuscript we have to the originals of Plato are 1,300 years. So when we talk about the New Testament being 250 years removed, we're talking in terms of ancient documents, very close. None of your professors will say that we don't have what Plato wrote, even though the closest we can get back to when he wrote them, it's 1,300 years. No one would say that. Why? Because things were different. They took transmission of text very seriously. That quote in the middle, our ability to reconstruct what the originals look like is exceedingly high. The contents of 97 to 99% of the text are certain beyond any reasonable doubt, far better than any other documents of the same age. Furthermore, no doctrine of the Christian faith hangs on any disputed text. I have in there, you can read them. There are reasons why there are. Most of the differences are differences between you and us. Whether the writer is including himself and who he's writing to, or if he's just saying it again. There are other variations that have to do with substituting synonyms and things like that. You can read those things. There are two major passages that are probably not original, and so if you're using like an NIV or a normal translation, they say in there, they have a little line, and they say, this is not found in the earliest reliable manuscripts. So again, the claim the Da Vinci Code's making is you can't trust it because of the transmission that has taken place over the years. But in fact, what we find is that you can. Even the translations you have today made by conservative evangelical Christians will tell you in the margins what the variations are. No one's trying to snow you, in other words. At the bottom there, Sir Frederick Kenyon, a world-renowned expert on archaeology and ancient manuscripts, said this: "The interval then between the dates of original composition and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as to be in fact negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established." All right, next question, top of the next page. How do we know that these four Gospels, and only these four Gospels, are the faithful witness of the Apostles? Where did the canon of the New Testament come from? What about the Gospel of Thomas? Are y'all familiar with the Gospel of Thomas? Have y'all heard about that? Some of y'all have heard about that. All right, several things here. Again, we don't have time to go through this whole thing, because I know none of y'all want to stay for the whole thing. So I'll try to move. Gaffin says this: "We must avoid confusing the existence of the canon with its recognition. What is constitutive, that is God's action, with what is reflexive, the church's action." Now here's what we know, the early stages. We know the importance of the apostles. We know that their presence was important, that their writings were important. We know the gospels are there. We know that by the end of the first century, two primary collections of writings were being distributed. Christians were the primary ones who started using the codex. A codex is a name for a book like this that's bound together. Before the early church, and it was around the time the early church came into being, most people used scrolls. But scrolls were problematic because you couldn't bind different scrolls together. So with the early church, they favored the codices, the actual plural, because you could bind together the Gospels. We know that the Gospels were being circulated together with their titles, according to Matthew, according to Mark, according to Luke, according to John. We know that another document was circulating called the Apostle. At first it had 10 of Paul's letters, and then the pastoral epistles were added to it. We know that the Acts of the Apostles were being circulated as well. Now, part of how the canon comes about is, so what I'm saying is, before any kind of heretical talk comes up, there is already implicitly a canon. And this is for a longer discussion if we just wanted to just talk about canon. But one of the claims that's being made, and this is what, one of the main things the Da Vinci Code is trying to get across, is look, there are 80 other Gospels that could have been included, but they weren't. And the primary one that you're going to hear people talk about, most of those Gospels come from the 4th century, okay? So most of the Gnostic documents are very, very late. The one that some will date earlier, to the middle of the 2nd century, about 150 or so, is the Gospel of Thomas. So I have in here the things about the Gospel of Thomas that differentiate it from the other Gospels are that it's mainly sayings. There's no history. Now, this is very significant because Judaism and Christianity, which grew out of Judaism, are historical religions. History is the heart of both of those religions. And so, as you see that there's no history, that's questionable about the Gospel of Thomas. Also, that it's enlightenment for the elite few. It's interesting because people talk about the Gospel of Thomas like it's all-inclusive. It's not. The very last saying in the whole book I put in here, it's Logion 1:14, Peter said to them, "Let Mary go away from us, because women are not worthy of life." Jesus said, "Lo, I shall lead her in order to make her a male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter into the kingdom of heaven." Now, this is Gnosticism. It is not Christianity. One of the things we'll talk about in a few minutes is the significance of women for the ministry of Jesus. The first testimony to the resurrection of Jesus is from women who could not testify in court in that day. And yet Jesus chose to appear to Mary first and to the other women at the tomb before he even appeared to the disciples. And so the idea that Jesus would say something that women need to become men is just, it's laughable. And yet this is what you're trying to be sold by people like Dan Brown writing the Da Vinci Code, wanting you to worship the Mother Goddess, wanting you to find Gnosticism as the primary thing. There are other things you could say about Gnosticism. This is a lecture on Gnosticism, but it's also ironic that while in Dan Brown, one of the things Dan Brown talks about is how worship of the Mother Goddess includes sexuality. And so the reason the church fought against it was because the church has a very low view of sex. Well, the ironic thing is that Gnosticism is anti-physical. So the Gospel of Thomas, one of the reasons it doesn't talk about history is because it doesn't like the body. Christianity, Judaism, and Christianity flowing out of Judaism love the body. It's created by God. Sex is something that God thought of, not us. He could have made us reproduce without pleasure, but he didn't. He could have just had talking communication between a husband and wife, but he didn't. He created sex, something pleasurable, something ecstatic. Why? Because God loves physicality. And so the ironic thing in the whole Dan Brown thing and all the talking about, you know, these sexual romps that you would have before the goddess, you know what one of the ways you worshiped the goddess as a man when you would go and worship? You can go to a temple of goddess worship, and there's a receptacle for when men in their ecstatic worship cut off their member. I don't know how do you say this in the college audience. When you you're no longer a man, there is a receptacle for you to put it in on your way out. Worshiping the goddess by cutting off your sexuality. That's very ironic, but I'm not here to talk about the Da Vinci Code. I'm here to defend them. It's Dan Brown. Basically, just Dan Brown is a lawyer. Lawyers are great, but he's not a historian. That's all I'm saying. He needs to study a little bit more. All right. There are other things we can say. The recognition of the canon. This is the other thing. Look on page 5. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip some. I've got some dates there as the agreement. Basically, what happened was this, is the church sat back and said, which documents have authority? Which documents do all the churches recognize as being faithful to who Jesus was and what the Old Testament teaches? Those were their two litmus tests, essentially. And so gradually they came to the central core. At no point in time was the Gospel of Thomas or any other Gnostic gospel even considered. Most of them weren't written until centuries later. But at no point in time would that fit, because it doesn't fit with Judaism. It does not fit with a God who would actually create. So F.F. Bruce says there in the middle of that page, it should be clear by now that our New Testament of 27 books does not represent the more or less arbitrary selection of some ecclesiastical synod or other, which sat around a table with a pile of Christian documents on it and said, now let us decide which of these are to be set apart as being divine authority. And that's exactly what's ironic. This was written before the Da Vinci Code, but that's what Dan Brown says. They sat down, they had 80 Gospels in front of them, and they decided which ones to use. And Bruce, this great historian, says that's not it. It was not until the 27 books had been generally accepted by Christians throughout the known world that they were first made the subject of a decree by an ecclesiastical council. All right. Who wrote the Gospels? What is their origin? Were they written by eyewitnesses? Was their testimony accurate and verifiable when written? I'm going to skip part of this, but right there at the bottom of page 5, read that quote in black. Thus, form criticism and also source criticism, I just don't have time to explain all these different kinds of criticisms, but form criticism has added its contribution to the overthrow of the hope once fondly held, that by getting back to the most primitive stage of the gospel tradition, we might recover a purely human Jesus who simply taught the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. That is what the liberal gospel teaches. In other words, he wasn't claiming to be God. He didn't claim to die on the cross for any specific purpose. He definitely wasn't raised from the dead. And so what the thinking was this, that if here the here's where all the action took place with Jesus, and if here in the latest dates, you know, that people can accept, if here is where they were actually written, then maybe if we can move back, maybe they're using sources and they're changing those sources. But every way that different scholars, both literary, philosophical, theological, historical, have attacked those things and gone after them, they've always ended up in all strata to find a Jesus who claims divinity, to find a Jesus who does miraculous deeds. And so there's not a getting back to just, you know, and one of the significant problems, I don't think I'll get to this later in the talk, but one of the significant problems, if all Jesus did was say, love God and love each other, then why kill him? You don't kill Mr. Rogers, you know? Mr. Rogers is your neighbor. He's not someone you crucify. So Jesus had to be doing something that was offensive. So you can read that, other things about some of the connections between the Gospels there. Bottom of page 6, that next question, number 7. Because there is some time between the occurrence of the events and the written record which we have, how can we be sure that the memories of Jesus' words and actions are correct? Even if they intended to tell the truth, do we know they could? So here we're not asking, did they intend to tell the truth? We're asking, could they tell the truth if they wanted to? And the answer is yes. I've summarized some discussion, which is actually a summary of even longer discussion. First, memorization was highly cultivated in first century Jewish culture. There were rabbis who had memorized all of the Old Testament and much of the oral tradition of the Jews. And so memorization, we don't memorize a lot now because we have computers, we have calculators, you know, we just don't memorize as much as we used to. We have books that are easily printable. Well, this is an oral culture where memorization is significant. Disciples, we have rules of disciples given by different rabbis, and one common characteristic is disciples were always required to memorize the rabbi's teaching word for word. In fact, we have one record that said, if your rabbi is teaching and you don't have a paper, write it on your sleeve. In other words, get it down so you can memorize it, so you can know it. Of the teaching we have from Jesus, scholars estimate 80, some will estimate 90, but I'm giving you the low number, estimate 80% was cast in poetic form. In other words, he spoke in a way that it would be easily remembered, easy to remember. Number 2, eyewitnesses to the words and works of Jesus, both friend and enemy, were still alive during the period of memory and of manuscript. So the followers of Jesus would not have been allowed by friend or enemy to fabricate stories. Kenneth Bailey has actually lived in the Near East, actually has found communities now that still live with this kind of memorization taking place. The next question, how do we know, this is number 8, how do we know they intended to tell the truth? Aren't the Gospels religious propaganda? How could the Gospel writers be objective? Okay. Now we could talk philosophically about, is it possible to be objective? You know, can CBS News really give both sides of the issue? Can Fox News really give both sides of the issue? If you try to be objective, but most people today would recognize that true objectivity, completely zero, you know, where you're not favoring either side, is an impossibility. But having said that, right there in the middle, the bold statement, the existence of hard sayings and the criteria of embarrassment argue strongly for the reliability of memory and for truth. The early church believed in the divinity of Christ, but they included Jesus saying, why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone. It's a quote from the Gospels. That could be, you know, if we were wanting to convince people that Jesus is God, we would kind of say, well, let's not put that one in. He denies knowing when he will return. He says only the Father knows. Much of his teaching is negative toward wealth. He's picking on the wealthy all the time. If you want your new religion to succeed, are you going to pick on the people that could actually give you the money to make it succeed? He says we must hate our father and mother in a patriarchal society. Those words sound somewhat harsh to us And we have no clue of what they would have sounded like in that society where families were so strong and where you wouldn't move. Most of y'all, many of y'all, probably aren't from Nashville, Tennessee. But in those days, you would have been near your family for pretty much your whole life. So this is a huge deal. He strongly denounces divorce in a culture where divorce was easy because women had no rights. A man could divorce a woman for whatever reason he wanted to, and he was attacked divorce. Why did John baptize Jesus instead of the other way around? What is baptism for? It points to repentance, doesn't it? It points to a need to be cleansed. So why, if you're writing this, would you have Jesus be baptized by John? Part of what's going on, well, I don't need to answer all those questions. Why do women play such a central role in the narrative in a deeply male-oriented society? Okay, you're the writers trying to blind everyone to the truth so that they'll follow this new religion you're making up, and you live in a male-oriented society. Women have practically no rights. They can't inherit land. They can't testify in court. And yet, what do? Women are the only ones at the foot of the cross. The men have run away. Women are the first to preach the gospel, to tell that Jesus has been raised. Women are highly significant. If you're trying to pull the wool over people's eyes, you don't do that. Why do the apostles look like idiots so often? You read the Gospel of Mark, it's like a comedy. You need to learn to laugh more when you read the Bible. We grew up in churches where it's like stiff, you know, some of you did anyway. Jesus is funny, and the Gospels are funny. Jesus is funny, you know, take the plank out of your own eye before you go after the speck in your brother's eye. You know, many of us heard serious sermons about that, about not judging. Well, they laughed the first time Jesus said that, I promise you, because the image is hilarious. That you've got this huge piece of wood coming out of your eye and you're over there trying to get this back. Read the Gospel of Mark. You will laugh at the apostles. Why? Because Jesus keeps saying, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And they keep saying, hey, can we say you're right and you're left when you come into your kingdom? Because they still think that he's going to establish a kingdom, a physical kingdom, so that means they get the positions of power. And he has to keep telling them. They say it again and again and again. We don't have time to show you that. Why does Jesus call himself the Son of Man when the apostles don't use that term in their writings? Also, if the writers felt free to make up sayings of Jesus, why don't they make up some to solve the problems raging in the early church? Significant disagreement in the early church over the inclusion of Gentiles, the role of circumcision, and the proper approach to speaking in tongues. If you were writing to address a later situation, you would have made up some saying of Jesus. If you felt the freedom to make Jesus say whatever you wanted him to say, you could have solved the problems of your day pretty easily. The gospel writers, I've already talked about bias. Okay, the next question, number 9. Are we completely dependent upon the gospels for our knowledge of Jesus? Does anyone else corroborate what the gospels claim? This is the corroboration test. Do we know anything else outside of the gospel? And the answer is yes. The basic elements of what the Gospels say can be corroborated. From Greco-Roman sources, these are primarily Pliny the Younger, Suetonius, and Tacitus, we learn that a man named Jesus lived and died on a cross in Palestine and founded the Christian movement. From Jewish sources, we learn that Jesus was conceived out of wedlock, gathered disciples, claimed divine authority, titles and prerogatives, worked miracles and magic. All of that is from the Talmud. We also learned that he was considered by many to be the Messiah, was accused by Jewish leaders, was condemned by Pilate, and was considered to be resurrected by his disciples. It is not surprising that contemporary historians so at the bottom, the top of that next page, page 8, nevertheless, even the scanty references corroborate almost the complete outline of Jesus' life, his unusual birth, his ministry, his miracles. They're chalked up to sorcery by the Talmud, but they're not denied. It's very much like what we see in the Gospels themselves. The Jewish leaders, the religious leaders in the Gospels themselves say that he's in league with Beelzebub. He's in league with a demon. That's how he can do these works. We get the same thing in the Talmud. His claims, his crucifixion, and the claims by many that they've met the risen Christ. Number 10, aren't the Gospels filled with contradictions? This is kind of something that everyone's heard, that the Gospels are filled with contradictions. But I loved at Vanderbilt when I would have students dialoguing with me, and one of them would say, well, aren't the Gospels? I'd say, well, where? And a lot of times they didn't know one. They just heard that. Now, there are some hard things. I say that at the bottom there. But most of them are apparent contradictions and tensions due to highly selective use of data or the selectivity of eyewitness memory. I'll give you a couple examples in there. It comes about from literary abridgment, chronological freedom, rearrangement, telescoping, some different things like that. A few things remain that we're not sure how they fit together. But for the most part, the Gospels correspond very well with one another. Number 11, if what you were saying is true, then why is the media always saying that scholars doubt most of the words of Jesus? I don't have time to read you this whole section. I did mention the Jesus seminar. Notice the black. This is from their own literature. This is not me making fun of it. It sounds kind of funny to me. But the meanings of the beads are given as follows. Red, that's Jesus. Pink, sure sounds like Jesus. Gray, well, maybe. Black, there's been some mistake. And what this is a group of scholars who most scholars that are liberal and conservative scholars that are not in this Jesus seminar look at it there with you know, they want to keep away from it. They're kind of embarrassed of it because it's not very well done historically. Basically, the summation, I give y'all can read through the ways they decide what is said and what isn't. R.T. France, a French scholar, said this, if anyone else in the world of the New Testament could have said the saying in question, it cannot be taken as the saying of Jesus. That's basically their rule. If anyone else might have said it, then it probably wasn't him. And there's no way you would ever treat any other historical document in that fashion. You can read through the two pages on that. But notice at the bottom, the Gospels actually hold up well even under these overly skeptical tools. On the basis of the criteria above, that I have problems with a lot of that criteria, as well as a lot of scholars have problems with that criteria, you still get most of what it said. And you still have the bulk of the Gospels, even if you go that real skeptical route. All right, let me just say a few things about my last point, page 10, and then I'll open it up for questions so we can interact. How can we believe the Gospels as historically reliable when they contain stories about miracles and the resurrection? For one thing, there's the Medivar that wrote The Limits of Science. But now that we're into postmodernism, most people recognize that science has not disproven the supernatural. So even scientists are more open than they used to be. And about 100 years ago, in the heat of modernity, you know, there were scientists who would just say there is nothing other than what we can prove. And Alvin Plantinga, the great philosopher who teaches at Notre Dame, says that this one scientist's complaint that historians must only use scientific methods. He says it comes close to the drunk who insisted on looking for his lost car keys under the street light on the grounds that the light was better there. So the guy's drunk, he's lost, dropped his keys, and so he walks over to the lighted area so he can find them. In fact, this is still Plantinga, the National Academy of Science would go the drunk one better. It would insist that because the keys would be hard to find in the dark, they must be under the light. anyway, y'all don't think that's funny. So it means I need to shut up. It's not funny. N.T. Wright has written a great book on the resurrection. N.T. Wright is the Bishop of Durham. I mentioned earlier, an Anglican bishop, and one of the preeminent scholars. You'll see him on PBS documentaries. You'll see him on you know, Dateline, you'll see him on. He's a guy that people will go to. He's recognized as a great scholar by liberal and conservative alike. And what I've done in these last three pages of your handout is summarize a concluding chapter. It's not the final chapter, but it's one of his concluding chapters on this book that he's written on the resurrection. Again, this is a problem. People say, well, if it talks about the fact that Jesus was raised from the dead, then, you know, what in the world's going on? Y'all can read that yourself. I'm going to step back and kind of tell you his argument. His argument is that, essentially, the only way to explain what we know of the early church, the only sufficient and necessary condition which explains the early church from a historian's perspective is that the resurrection actually happened. Now, he argues this for 750 pages, so there's no way I can convince you of this in 3.5 minutes, okay? But here's basically what he says. You have the Greek world and the Jewish world, primarily. He goes through all the Greek sources, and he shows that the Greeks always used the word resurrection for a physical, bodily resurrection. Always physical and bodily. And the Greeks, without exception, said it can't happen. It's a fantasy. In the Jewish world, the Jews only talked about resurrection as a physical, bodily resurrection. And the Jews said, the bulk of the Jews, there were some Jews who didn't believe in a resurrection. The bulk of them believed in a resurrection, but it happens at the end of time. But what the consensus view is that resurrection and resurrection terminology always refers to a physical and bodily resurrection. What you'll do, you can go to churches here in town that talk about the resurrection as a nice idea. They'll use the term resurrection, but they don't mean that Jesus bodily or physically rose from the grave. They mean that it's kind of a nice idea that his spirit lived on, and it's kind of a, you know, spring comes after winter. The problem is, spring comes after winter sounds great to you who are in college, but that's not good news to the prostitute. That's not good news to the drunk. That's not good news to the crack addict. They need a little bit something more than spring comes after winter. They need a real resurrection. What Wright says is everybody in that time used it for physical bodily resurrection. And no one expected it to happen. So the idea that they would just come up with this, and he talks about this historical reliability, and he examines all the texts on the resurrection from the New Testament and from other sources. And what he does is he says, if you look over on page 12, and what I've done is I'm quoting him, but I'm quoting it to summarize. I'm just trying to give you a taste of his work. And he comes to this category. Well, look at page 11, actually, the bottom of page 11, right after that last bracket, the last kind of full paragraph. It is always possible that in discussing the resurrection, someone will come up with a skeptical critic's dream, an explanation which provides a sufficient condition for the rise of early Christian faith. It is worthy of note that despite the somewhat desperate attempts of many scholars of the last 200 years, not to mention critics since at least Celsus, no such explanation has been found. The early Christians did not invent the empty tomb and the meetings or sightings of the risen Jesus in order to explain a faith they already had. They developed that faith because of the occurrence and convergence of these two phenomena. Nobody was expecting this kind of thing. No kind of conversion experience would have generated such ideas. Nobody would have invented it, no matter how guilty or forgiven they felt, no matter how many hours they pored over the scriptures. To suggest otherwise is to stop doing history and to enter into a fantasy world of our own, a new cognitive dissonance in which the relentless modernists, desperately worried about the post-Enlightenment worldview, seems in imminent danger of collapse, devising strategies for shoring it up anyway. Here's what he's saying. This is not something a group would have just invented. No historian could come to that conclusion because Everybody believed it was physical and bodily. And the only people believed that it could happen, believed it could happen at the end of time. Not in the middle of time. That's what blows Paul's mind, the change from Saul to Paul on the Damascus Road, that it would happen in the middle of time. And, you know, the argument that most of us have heard and know is that dead people don't rise from the dead. You know, we all know that, don't we? Well, that's an accepted fact of the first century as well. What a lot of people say is, well, those people were snookered. They're kind of stupid back then, but we are enlightened. We have science. We know that dead people don't rise from the grave. Nonsense. They believed it was just as impossible as we do. And so he's dealing with this as an historian. He says it's the only sufficient and necessary. And so top of page 12, bottom of page 11, very last beginning of a sentence. In terms of the kind of proof which historians normally accept, the case we have presented that the tomb plus appearance of combination is what generated early Christian belief is as watertight as one is likely to find. The next underlined section, I regard this conclusion as coming in the same category of historical probability so high as to be virtually certain as the death of Augustus in AD 14 or the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. That next section, the fact that dead people do not ordinarily rise is itself part of early Christian belief, not an objection to it. The early Christians insisted that what had happened to Jesus was precisely something new, was indeed the start of a whole new mode of existence and new creation. The fact that Jesus' resurrection was and remains without analogy is not an objection to the early Christian claim. It is part of the claim itself. Now he goes on to say, look at that next section, what if the resurrection, instead of, as is often imagined, legitimating a cozy, comfortable, socially and culturally conservative form of Christianity, should turn out to be in the 21st century, as in the first, the most socially, culturally, and politically explosive force imaginable. The next bold section, we're almost done. My claim is stronger that the bodily resurrection of Jesus provides the necessary condition for these things. In other words, that no other explanation could or would be. All the efforts to find alternative explanations fail, and they were bound to do so. But then he observes that saying that Jesus of Nazareth was bodily raised from the dead is not only a self-involving statement, it is a self-committing statement. Here's the point, and again, this is 750 pages of argument. If you're skeptical about the resurrection, this is a great thing to read. It stands on, it's volume 3 of a series, but it stands as its own monograph. But here's the point that he's making, is that if we apply history to this event the way we apply history to other events, the conclusion that you have to come to is that Jesus was raised from the dead. And but he points out that that's not something you can say and remain kind of, okay, it's all right. Because if he's raised from the dead, then he is Lord, and he controls your life, and you kneel to him, and so it's a self-involving statement as well. Questions about any of this? I know this has been a whirlwind tour. Sure. Okay. Well, here's the fuller argument. Okay. Yeah, the question is this. When I talked about Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas and the statement about the women, where women need to become men, that it seemed that I disproved the Gospel of Thomas by using the Gospels. So in other words, what I'm doing is circular, that I'm proving the Gospels by using the Gospels to prove the Gospels. Okay? Am I restating it fairly? What I would do is all reasoning ultimately is circular, but they're good and bad circles. Okay, there's small circles and there are large circles where you bring in a whole lot of data to investigate. And so part of the bigger argument against the Gospel of Thomas is to ask, what would Jesus, a first century Jewish man, have taught and believed? And so what you have here, in the way you look at that, this is part of what N.C. Wright does, if you have Jesus right here, then he needs to be connected to his Judaic upbringing, all right? So what he teaches has to make sense flowing out of Judaism, but it also has to have some connection to the church that follows. And so you can get at who Jesus was by studying in both directions, by looking at Judaism, which is both the Old Testament and Second Temple Judaism, which is documents post-Old Testament documents. And at the same time, you study back with the early church. And so the bigger circle of that argument is that the idea that a Jewish person would teach something against the Gnostic, against the body, the fundamental thing that separated the Jewish people from the rest of the world was that, well, at that time, the bulk of the religions at that time, was that God was actually the creator. And so you hear a lot of talk about creation. Because most of the other religions at that time viewed physicality as something bad. Plato says, you know, the body is the prison house of the soul. So real redemption ultimately comes when you get away from your body. So what I'm saying is this. I'm using a bigger argument. What we know from the Gospels fits about Jesus, both liberal and conservative scholars would say that, you know, even the Jesus seminar people would fit some of the sayings of Jesus in this continuum of Judaism flowing into the early church. It fits. Most of those scholars would say that a Gnostic statement like that is completely disconnected from both what comes before Jesus and what comes after. And so what I'm doing is I'm saying what everyone can agree on, both liberal and conservative, about the Gospels. So if a liberal person is standing in here who discounts a half of what the Gospels say, okay, whereas I believe it all, they say only half of it probably is historically true, they would question that statement with the same reason. They would say, here are the things we know to be true about Jesus based on the corroboratory evidence, based on the connection between Judaism flowing into the early church, and that kind of statement is at dissonance. That Gnosticism has its seed form in the late first century, but it really isn't full-blown until the middle of the second century, and especially grows more later. Am I getting at your answer? So there's a bigger circle I'm wanting to draw from. Yes. Yeah, yes, you're hearing me right, but that's N.T. Wright's argument. He's saying, let me look at these documents historically. So how would a historian study this movement? And he says, we know a lot about this, we know a lot about that, and so what makes sense of a movement from this to that? And so, yes. I'm not saying that's the only way you approach the Gospels, but I'm saying that's N.T. Wright's, which it's a confirmation for the truth of the Gospels reliability. Yes. Okay. Yes. 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 Okay. Other questions? Anything? Everyone's just ready for me to end this thing, right? Put us out of our misery, please. No questions. You sure? I would encourage you to take the time to read through this a little bit more slowly. Ask. One of the things I always told my students at Vanderbilt is to be a Christian, you don't need to check your brain at the door. You can ask whatever question you want to ask about the Christian faith, about the Scriptures. So don't back away from asking questions. Go back and read through this. If you kind of have a question but you're scared to ask because you don't want to look, you know, stupid or something in front of everybody else, then ask later. Go ask Kevin, or he can get you in touch with me. But think through these things. If you're a Christian, think through them so that you know that you have a reason to be a Christian. If you're not a Christian, think through them just to say, should I consider the claims of Christ? thanks for having me.